Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Last week, you heard an essay by Amy Krauss Rosenthal. It was called, You May Want to Marry My Husband. The essay was published just days before Amy died of ovarian cancer. This past summer, her husband Jason wrote his own modern love essay called My Wife Said You May Want to Marry Me. It's read by Andre Holland. He's the executive producer and star of High Flying Bird, now on Netflix and in select theaters.
I am that guy. A little over a year ago, my wife, Amy Krauss Rosenthal, published a modern love essay called You May Want to Marry My Husband. At 51, Amy was dying from ovarian cancer. She wrote her essay in the form of a personal ad. It was more like a love letter to me. Those words would be the final ones Amy published. She died 10 days later. Amy couldn't have known that her essay would afford me an opportunity to fill this same column with words of my own, telling you what has happened since. I don't pretend to have Amy's extraordinary gift with words and wordplay, but here goes. During our life together, Amy was a prolific writer, publishing children's books, memoirs, and articles. Knowing she had only a short time to live, she wanted to finish one last project. We were engaged then in home hospice, a seemingly beautiful way to deal with the end of life, where you care for your loved one in familiar surroundings, away from the hospital with its beeping machines and frequent disruptions. I was posted up at the dining room table overlooking our living room, where Amy had established her workstation. From her spot on the couch, she worked away between micro naps. These brief moments of peace were induced by the morphine needed to control her symptoms. A tumor had created a complete bowel obstruction, making it impossible for her to eat solid food. She would flutter away on the keyboard, doze a bit, then awake and repeat. When Amy finished her essay, she gave it to me to read, as she had done with all of her writing. But this time was different. In her memoirs, she had written about the children and me, but not like this. How was she able to combine such feelings of unbearable sadness, ironic humor, and total honesty? When the essay was published, Amy was too sick to appreciate it. As the international reaction became overwhelming, I was torn up, thinking how she was missing the profound impact her words were having. The reach of Amy's article and of her greater body of work was so much deeper and richer than I knew. Letters poured in from around the world. They included notes of admiration, medical advice, commiseration, and offers from women to meet me. I was too consumed with grief during Amy's final days to engage with the responses. It was strange having any attention directed at me right then. But the outpouring did make me appreciate the significance of her work. When people ask me to describe myself, I always start with Dad. Yet I spent a great deal of my adult life being known as Amy's husband. People knew of Amy and her writing, while I had lived in relative anonymity, I had no social media presence, and my profession, a lawyer, did not cast me into public view. After Amy died, I faced countless decisions in my new role as a single father. As in any marriage or union of two people with children, we had a natural division of labor. Not anymore. People often assumed Amy was disorganized because she had list upon list, scattered post-it notes, scraps of paper, and even messages scrawled on her hand. But she was one of the most organized people I have ever met. There are aspects of everyday life I have taken on that I never gave much consideration to in the past. How did Amy hold everything together so seamlessly? I'm capable of doing many things on my own, but two people can accomplish so much more together and also support each other through life's ups and downs. Many women took Amy up on her offer, sending me a range of messages, overly forward, funny, wise, moving, sincere. In a 6-page handwritten letter, one woman marketed her automotive knowledge, apparently in an effort to woo me. I do know how to check the radiator in a vehicle to see if it may need a tad of water before the engine blows up. While I do not know much about reality TV, there was also this touching letter submitted by the child of a single mother who wrote, "I'd like to submit an application for my mom, like friends and family can do for participants on The Bachelor." And I appreciated the sentiment and the style of a woman who wrote this. "I have this image of queues of hopeful women at the Green Mill Jazz Club on Thursday nights. Single mothers, elegant divorcees, spinster aunts, bored housewives, daughters, wilting violets, all in anxious anticipation as to whether the shoe will fit them alone, that the prince from the fairy tale is meant for them, that they are the right person." I couldn't digest any of these messages at the time, but I've since found solace and even laughter in many of them. One thing I've come to understand, though, is what a gift Amy gave me by emphasizing that I had a long life to fill with joy, happiness, and love. Her edict to fill my own empty space with a new story has given me permission to make the most out of my remaining time on this planet. If I can convey a message I've learned from this bestowal, it would be this. Talk with your mate, your children, and other loved ones about what you want for them when you are gone. By doing this, you give them liberty to live a full life and eventually find meaning again. There will be so much pain, and they will think of you daily. But they will carry on and make a new future, knowing you gave them permission and even encouragement to do so. I want more time with Amy. I want more time picnicking and listening to music at Millennium Park. I want more Shabbat dinners with the five of us Rosies, as we Rosenthals are referred to by our family. I would even gladly put up with Amy taking as much time as she wants to say goodbye to everyone at our family gatherings, as she always used to do, even after we had been there for hours, had a long drive home ahead of us, and likely would see them again in a few days. I wish I had more of all of those things, just as Amy had wished for more. But more wasn't going to happen for her or us. Instead, as she described, We followed Plan B, which was about being present in our lives because time was running short. So we did our best to live in the moment until we had no more moments left. The cruelest irony of my life is that it took me losing my best friend, my wife of 26 years, and the mother of my 3 children to truly appreciate each and every day. I know that sounds like a cliche, and it is, but it's true. Amy continues to open doors for me, to affect my choices, send me off into the world to make the most of it. Recently, I gave a TED talk on the end of life and my grieving process that I hope will help others. Not something I ever pictured myself doing, but I'm grateful for the chance to connect with people in a similar position. And of course, I'm writing to you now only because of her. I am now aware, in a way I wish I never had to learn, that loss is loss is loss. Whether it's a divorce, losing a job, having a beloved pet die, or enduring the death of a family member. In that respect, I am no different. But my wife gave me a gift at the end of her column when she left me that empty space. One I'd like to offer you, a blank space to fill. The freedom and permission to write your own story. Here is your empty space. What will you do with your own fresh start? Humbly, Jason.
That's Andre Holland reading Jason Rosenthal's essay, My Wife Said You May Want to Marry Me. We'll catch up with Jason after the break. When we talked to Jason Rosenthal, he told us what it was like to take care of his wife in the final days of her life.
During the time that Amy was in hospice, we were really focused on making the end of her life as beautiful as it could be. And there was no guidebook. But what I did, is I tried to make it beautiful. For some reason, candles spoke to me. Candles symbolized life in different ways, you know, that some could be small and last a short while, others burned for months. And so we had candles all over our home. We had family come in. We had our close friends on another evening. I invited in musicians to play for Amy. And so we did our best to make that time for her as beautiful as it could be. And it was, by the way, not always beautiful. It was extraordinarily painful and hard. And my kids were incredible.
During her illness, Jason says that he and Amy had many conversations about parenting their 3 children.
And one of the things I really wanted to ask her was, you know, how am I going to do this without you? You're like the best mom ever, and it seems so natural to you. And she flat out assured me that the kids love you, and you're a great parent, and they're also not little kids anymore, you know? But filling that void is impossible, and I don't pretend to be able to be mom. I'm just doing my best to be able to be dad. So I'm doing my best.
we asked Jason about the blank space at the end of Amy's essay and if it felt like a gift or a burden.
I mean, that blank space has allowed me to lift my head up, like, in the morning, in the first few months. Even though I was extraordinarily emotional and deep in the throes of grief, I took that as a gift, you know, and I was able to continue my life forward. I know that there are many people out there who have never had conversations with their spouses or family or been told something so specifically like Amy provided for me that struggle quite a bit and never really emerge from those deep throes of grief. I think a full life looks much different than it did before. Let's be honest. It's been almost 2 years, and I have had a great deal of difficulty engaging again with what I did professionally, which was being a lawyer. And I'm trying to make each day, each week, meaningful in some way to me.
Jason says that he's still receiving letters from readers describing their own grief, or they're reaching out to him with the hope of starting a relationship. He hasn't responded to any of the people seeking romance and doesn't think he will. But over time, he's gone back to the letters and found humor in some of them. One stands out.
Obviously, someone spent some time on it, and it essentially said, "I will marry you when you are ready, provided you permanently stop drinking. No other conditions, and I promise to outlive you." That was it. I don't know how that applies to my life, but it really did make me laugh.
And as for future relationships?
You know, there's this huge hole or void in my heart that's taken up by someone else, because the truth is, you know, and I don't have any experience with this, but I never fell out of love with someone. You know, I will always love Amy. She will always be there with me and with whoever the us may be. And so whoever decides to end up with me needs to embrace that.
That's Jason Rosenthal. He started a foundation in Amy's honor that funds ovarian cancer research and childhood literacy initiatives. He lives in Chicago. More after the break. Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, says that he gets a lot of submissions about loss, but Amy Krauss Rosenthal's essay was special.
For me, the subject matter was not new. Her approach to it, with this sort of fresh, funny, "here's my husband, he's going to be available soon" kind of tone, that's what was remarkable about it. That she, as a writer, could take this situation that she was in the middle of right then, she wasn't writing this with distance, she was in the middle of it right then, and come up with sort of an artistic approach and to be able to say, "I'm going to write this in the form of a personal ad for my husband who's soon to be single." You know, on the one hand, that's incredibly morbid, and on the other hand, there's sort of a genius to it. Like, even death needs an angle, you know, and in this case, the angle was meaningful and deep and spoke to her generosity about his future. And it's a way of talking about death. You know, you have to find new ways to talk about things. And she did.
After Amy's piece came out, a lot of readers wanted to know more about Jason Rosenthal.
One very common response to Amy's essay was, "What's the story with Jason?" And he was very understandably private about all of that. But I was happy to hear from him a year later with his own response to this essay and how it impacted him. And he'd taken the time he needed, and his family was comfortable. He wanted to write an essay to sort of address that curiosity and to maybe dispel the romance of it a little bit and say, "This was meaningful to me for this reason, despite reader expectations that this would lead to love for me. This was the reality. It was a love letter to me, that's how I took it, and that's the lesson that I feel like I can spread.
And here's Andre Holland on why he connected with this essay.
I've always struggled with loss in my life. And last year was a year of a lot of loss. And as I get older and my family gets older, I'm aware. And I don't know, I think that this piece really, there's a beauty to it. And there's a hopefulness about it that I really found touching.
Thanks again to Andre Holland for reading this week's essay. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Perotti. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.